From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and, we think, entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with my co-host John Wells. Today, we speak with Kitty Ferguson. She talks about lost science stories. They're astonishing tales of forgotten genius. She talks about, in her new book by the same title, 10 individuals who played a role, however obscure, in forming the science that we treasure today.
Good morning, Lynn. And then we speak with Dave Levitin. He's a journalist and has written a book that's very timely for reasons we may not need to state. His book is called Not a Scientist: How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. He begins with President Reagan and the first utterance of the statement, I'm not a scientist, but, well, stay tuned for this conversation.
These guests, plus today's cool story when we return. It's Cool Science Radio on KPCW.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with John Wells. Our first guest is Kitty Ferguson. She'll be joining us to talk about the history of science and 10 individuals who shaped the science that we know today. But you may not have heard of them. In fact, you probably haven't. I mean, have you ever heard of Ferdinand Verbiest or Jean-Baptiste Chaptoteroche? How did I do on pronunciation there?
I think you did great.
How about Lisa Meitner, who should have shared the Nobel Prize for Chemistry back in 1944 for splitting the atom? That is a story that is fascinating to me and really a bit tragic. Kitty Ferguson has written a new book. It's about history and it's about science. And those who love either or both will love this conversation. Ferguson has been writing and lecturing for over 2.5 decades on science and scientists, and her biography, Stephen Hawking, Quest for the Theory of Everything, was an international bestseller. We're pleased that Kitty Ferguson could join us on Cool Science Radio. Kitty, good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, your book is very, just interesting and accessible, and as you say in your biography, that's sort of what you've been trying to do over the years that you've been talking about science and the history of science, is really bringing it to folks who might not otherwise know about science.
Well, that's true. I kind of follow after my father, who was also, as myself, not a scientist, a musician, he loved to explain things, and every time he read something when we were children, and most of the time that was something scientific because he loved science, he always said, I can't really understand it until I can explain it to you kids. And I'm not writing for children, and I'm not really dumbing down the science, but I do try very hard to translate the language of scientists into the language of the rest of us, because very often scientists don't really realize where to draw the line between the two. They think they're making things understandable, and really they're not. So that's what I try to do, and I love to do it. I have such fun looking for ways to do it. But what really I loved about this particular book, these 10 stories in lost science, is the people in it. I just think the people are so fascinating. I mean, these people who were so passionate about science, they were willing to risk their lives, and one lost his life. It's a book of ripping yarns, as they say, and it's not yarns, it's all true.
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that your father was a very wise man, as we all know that as we retell the stories to others. That's when it cements the learning for ourselves. And also mm-hmm. that's when it sort of increases our curiosity and then hopefully our audience's curiosity. So I love what he did, not only for himself, but for his kids. So that's great. I have to say that I guess I always gravitate towards women in science. And even though it's about two-thirds of the way through your book, this morning I was sitting down with coffee and reading about Lisa Meitner. I don't know if I say that right.
That's a sad and wonderful story. I didn't know about her before I wrote this book. One of my atomic physicist friends introduced me to her name. And I ended up really liking her so well.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about, I mean, first of all, she is a woman in science when women weren't in science, very often not even allowed into the laboratories and not allowed to, you know, co-publish or anything like that. So take us through sort of that part of her history and the time, you know, that she was doing that.
Yes, that's right. I think one thing that interested me was that here she was trying to matriculate at an Austrian university, the University of Vienna, and it was possible for a woman to do that in her time. I was very surprised. I'm trying to remember the date when that became possible, but a little earlier, I think, than it would have been here in America. Of course, when she went then on for her PhD at the University of Berlin, she was not allowed to actually matriculate. She had to just attend lectures and things and work in the labs. Women were not allowed in chemistry labs because their hair might catch fire. And nobody seemed to worry about the men's beards, which seemed more likely to catch fire in a chemistry lab. She and her co-worker there, Otto Hahn, who was the man who finally did win the Nobel Prize, had to have their lab, their chemistry physics lab, there in a basement janitor's closet. That's where they were. And she didn't even have a bathroom she could go to. She had to walk down the street to a hotel to use the bathroom. This was the situation. When she first met the great physicist Ernest Rutherford, who knew a great deal about her work, he was so surprised. He said, "I thought you were a man." And then his wife was there, too. And she and Lisa Meitner were sent off Christmas shopping while Rutherford discussed physics with her partner there, Hahn. So this was the situation she was in. It was just nobody was trying, you know, specifically to embarrass her or put her down. It was just the way of the times. And when she gave her talk, her inaugural lecture there, when she finally did become a professor in Vienna, they called it the problems of cosmetic physics in the newspaper instead of the problems of cosmic physics. These were just the kind of things she ran into and did well. And well, by the time she was excluded from the Nobel Prize, she was world famous. Everybody in her field knew her very well, knew her work, knew how fine it was, and I don't think anybody in the physics or chemistry field would have wanted to see her left out of that prize. I think there was quite a shock when she was.
And from the very beginning, she was sort of put off to the side, because when she was doing this groundbreaking research, she always had to take a back seat, letting, for an example, Otto Hahn report on their joint research. So from the very beginning, she was sort of told what her place was, although things did change. I mean, they put a woman's bathroom outside the lab,
yes,
and she was allowed to.
They finally did. They got a good lab, and they got a good bathroom. That's right. But I also think she contributed somewhat to this herself. She was the one who made her, who always let him do this. I'm sure had she stepped forward and insisted on doing some of this reporting herself when they met in the colloquium and so on, I don't think she would have been stopped. But she did kind of stay in the background. And during the war, when he was away, and she discovered, I think that was protactinium that she discovered at that time, she discovered it. It had been their work, but she discovered it while he was gone. She still gave him all the credit for him. She put him first on the publication of it, and that was a little bit asking for it. She didn't have to do that, and I don't really know why she did.
Right. Well, I'm proud of Einstein. Einstein wrote in his Out of My Later Years in 1950, and this, of course, is in your book. I did not know this before. Mm-hmm. He said, "I do not consider myself the father of the release of atomic energy. My part in it was quite indirect. I did not, in fact, foresee that it would be released in my time. I believed only that it was theoretically possible. It was discovered by Hahn in Berlin, and he misrepresented what he discovered. It was Lise Meitner who provided the correct interpretation." And that interpretation, as you relay in your book, as you relate to in your book, was actually very easy to understand, but nobody was looking at it that way.
No, that's exactly right. But I think that, as you know, from having read the book, that she had to leave Berlin because she was a Jewish woman in Nazi Germany. She had to escape, and I think that's one of the exciting incidents in the book is her escape, the way she got away from Germany. Then she was in Sweden there. Because of that escape, which she had no choice in that, I mean, she really had to do that, it put the burden of proof on her rather than anybody else that she was really part of the final discovery. And I think, not that she tried to prove it, but I mean, then it became a question. Had she actually been there in Berlin at the time of that discovery, I don't think I think she would have won the Nobel Prize. And I think that that was the problem. And that's the sad thing about her having to make that escape. That's why I call the chapter Escape to Obscurity, because that just cut her out.
Kitty, I have a question for you about how all this happened. When the model of the atom came out, and there were various interpretations of what the atom might look like, and there were mm-hmm. all sorts of different ways to work with electrons, protons, neutrons. Whose idea was it to, hey, let's take uranium and bombard it with neutrons? Because they spent a tremendous amount of time experimenting with that, and that, of course, is what really brought the atomic age to us.
That's right. Well, it was James Chadwick who discovered the neutron in 1932, which was the magic bullet to split the atom finally, who came up with the idea that there was a neutron. I'm afraid I haven't got that at my fingertips, but he was responsible for discovering it. And as we know now, there are neutrons in the nuclei of all atoms. I think that's right.
Yes, yeah.
I hope so. I always make a statement like that. I think, wait a minute. Yes, okay.
Well, Lynn and I aren't going to correct you, I'll tell you that.
There might be somebody out there marking my paper. I can't say where that idea emerged, why anybody thought in the first place to look for it. I'm sure there were good reasons, and if I gave it a lot of thought, I could probably figure it out, but I can't really tell you that.
Well, it's so interesting.
But it is. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Kitty, just this conversation that we're having here and the fact that you wrote the international bestseller, Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind, it is very interesting to me that you have to take science that may not be in your background, learn it enough to then decipher it, which is a pretty tall order. How fun for you.
I love doing it. I can't claim to understand, all of Stephen Hawking's formulas and everything like that, equations. No, I can't. I mean, that's just beyond me. But what I do is I try my best to do something and explain it. And then I always run. I always run my what I've written by the person, like Stephen Hawking. He would look at it, and it's not always he. It's somebody else's theory, whoever's theory it is. I try to go really to the person and say, look, this is the way I've explained this. Would you look at it, see if it really reflects what you've theorized, and, have I done you justice? And sometimes people do make corrections, and that's fine. That's why I go to them. But most of the time, I think scientists are grateful to have somebody able and willing to try to explain what they do on a more ordinary person level, as Stephen Hawking calls the rest of us ordinary people.
Right. Well, that's what John and I try to do every week on this show. And it's funny, no matter how many times we do interviews about black holes, I really just will continue to understand them on a very peripheral level, which is okay, you know, because it's, I guess it shows that we all, even if we're not scientists, we can have the curiosity and we can sort of delve into these worlds.
Yes.
And I wonder how many times when you run what you've written back by the scientists with the theory, you know, how often they say, oh, this is a gross oversimplification of decades of my work. Or do they say, wow, I never would have been able to say it in this simple of a fashion?
I've never really had an ugly reaction to what I've written. Most people are really appreciative. They'll make small corrections, and sometimes they'll, I remember with the physicist John Wheeler, famous American physicist, who was a mentor to just about everybody in physics in America today. When I took him my black hole book the first time, this was a book, the first book I wrote before I wrote my first Stephen Hawking biography. I wrote a book on black holes, and it was for children or young adults. And I took it to him. I had no idea what he was going to say. He didn't have time to visit me in his office. He says, I have to ride the bus into New York from Princeton. You want to come ride the bus with me and we'll talk about this? So I said, yes. So I did. And, but I loved one thing that he said, and I think you'll appreciate this too. I had used the phrase, we have discovered, several times in the book. We have discovered. And he said, you're going to get a little criticism for that because you could have said scientists have discovered, or you might have named the people, but if, you know, if it's really a on-run well-known discovery, you can say we, but he said, always say we have discovered. Always say that. This science belongs to everybody. We have discovered. And he insisted on that. And I appreciated that so much. I haven't always been able to use that phrase because there is some objection to it sometimes. But, and, you know, it implies that I was part of the discovery. And, but what I really did appreciate his backing me up on that. I like that.
I like that, too. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Kitty Ferguson, who's written a fascinating book, Lost Science, Astonishing Tales of Forgotten Genius. And, Kitty, I wanted to ask you, you open up in the 1600s with a 14-year-old emperor, a couple of regents, Oboy and Ebelon, who are trying to discredit this emperor and trying to push him out. And then this Jesuit, Vebiest, and I think I've butchered all the pronunciations so far, might as well keep going. And can you tell that story?
Well, yes, because I just think that's a marvelous story. This was in China. It was the Kangxi Emperor, which is not easy to pronounce when you see the spelling, but that's what it was, the Kangxi Emperor. He was 14 years old. His father had appointed these two regents to rule China during his minority. And but they were, actually his father had appointed four of them, and two of them had killed the other two. So, you know, it wasn't a great bunch there. But the boy was brilliant, and he really wanted to take over this empire now. And he used the most astounding tool, the Chinese calendar. He knew there were discrepancies in it. He knew it was a very troubling thing for China. You know, Chinese science and astronomy goes way back in a wonderful way, but this was at a low ebb at this time. And he knew that there were these Jesuit astronomers who could perhaps help, and he called them in. They were actually under house arrest, had been almost killed by their opponents. He brought them in and put them through this series of tests. The Vebiest had to measure for 3 days in a row where the sun would fall at noon on this scale that he had in the courtyard there. Every day, everybody came out, the women in their dresses, the mandarins, everybody came out to watch this happen. It was really a test. It was if Vebiest hadn't been able to do that, he probably would not have lived. I think that this was really a scary thing. And the emperor required him to do it three times, at first in a very low-key way, and then more and more out in the open. The boy was you know, sneaking up on these opponents of his. And eventually, that is the way he took over the empire, by making use of this of Vebiest's knowledge. And it's just a wonderful story. It's just, you know, when I encountered it, I actually came upon Vebiest in the first place by hearing about his little automobile that he invented for the emperor later on, his little automotive machine, which was can be called the first automobile. But when you hear about this earlier story, I mean, it's something Indiana Jones would be proud to be part of. It's just amazing.
And there was some luck involved, because I think Verbius thought himself that he had never actually nailed this this shadow machine hitting the exact date.
That's right.
So he got lucky.
Well, he didn't think it was luck. He said only with the help of God could he have done that.
Okay.
So he attributed it that way. But yes, I mean, because it hadn't really worked that well for him every time. But it did, just brilliantly, three times right on the money. And everybody astounded. You know, it was quite something. It would make a wonderful scene in a movie.
Yeah. And I learned something that I didn't really know before. I mean, the shadow machine, the steam-driven automobile, I mean, that's all that is fascinating. But the whole notion of how important a calendar is, because an emperor, according to your book, and I believe it, is divine, you know, has come from the heavens. Therefore, that emperor should know exactly when a lunar eclipse will take place and those sorts of things. So it was important that these calendars were, that the emperor's calendar was spot on. And if the emperor couldn't produce a calendar like that, then people would start to question his divinity.
Yes, that's right, or at least his connections with the heavens, that's right. And the calendar, as they had it, was pretty far off. It was off a whole day on occasion, and they were having to add a 13th month to the year. Everything was crazy about it. And Verbiest, and what's interesting, too, to me, is that you might say Verbiest did this because he was from the West and he knew Copernican astronomy. He did not know Copernican astronomy. He knycthe compromise astronomy of Tycho Brahe, which was a compromise between the old picture of the solar system revolving completely around the Earth and the new system of the solar system revolving around the Sun. Because Tycho Brahe's cosmos, his theory, was a compromise between the two and was perfectly plausible, could perfectly served Verbiest as far as finding out where that shadow would fall, because it is the geometric equivalent of the Copernican system. And but he didn't know Copernican astronomy at all. This was Tychonic astronomy, and it was a dead end. It never went anywhere. But that's what he brought to China.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Kitty Ferguson. She's talking about stories from a chosen 10 of some well-forgotten genius, 10 individuals, each of whom played a role, however obscure, in forming the science that we treasure today. So incredible risk-takers, spies, scoundrels, as she says, and unsung heroes. Well, let's take a look at one whose name is a little easier to pronounce, Barry Sternman, and also more more modern day. And you know, you talk about a couple of the different categories that Barry Sternman, who studied at UCLA, came into. You know, some people who were a little bit before their time, I guess you would say. Discovering things before the scientific community was really ready for them. Talk about Barry Sternman.
Well, he's very interesting. He was brought to my attention by my brother-in-law, who works in the field of neuroscience. And Barry Sternman, through a series of experiments he was doing with cats, discovered a way to get these cats to kind of go into a... Well, maybe I should explain that a little better. Just to be quick about it, if a cat pressed a lever, he got food, okay?
Right.
Then Barry Sternman changed the experiment to where a tone would sound. And as long as that tone was sounding, no matter how many times the cat pushed the lever, there was no food coming out. So the cat learned to wait until the tone was not sounding. And Sternman noticed that this waiting had a special quality to it. It had the quality of an animal... like a lion waiting for its prey, that kind of stillness, okay? And an EEG of the cat at that time showed an electrical frequency that no researcher had studied in detail before. I think it had been noticed but never really studied. And Sternman called that the SMR, or sensomotor rhythm. So then the next part of the experiment was that the food would arrive only when the cat could produce a half second of that frequency. So the cats actually learn to produce that at will. And later he found that the cats who had learned to do that, he was using in another experiment with rocket fuel, which people were having trouble with. Actually, I think it's a wonderful story that astronauts were claiming they saw people waving at them from the South Pacific as they flew over, in the, you know, as they orbited the Earth. And people thought, yeah, well, we better look into this. You know, not in the South Pacific. Let's see what's getting to these guys' brains. And it was this rocket fuel. So they tested it on some poor cats. You feel sorry for them. But the cats who had been part of that earlier experience and learned to produce SMR were able to resist their reaction, the seizures that came with being exposed to this rocket fuel. So we took it on from there to study how it would work with epilepsy, and it was very successful. Not always completely successful, but some epileptics were able to get driver's license, drive cars. They were able to control their epilepsy so well.
Wow.
But then Barry Sterman's, he kept getting good grants to follow up on this. He was in the middle of a big 3-year grant to investigate how the treatment could be used in hospitals and doctors' offices when his money was cut off. And he says at that time he thinks there was a little bit of, people didn't like him, but mainly it was because the pharmaceuticals were taking over the field, drugs instead of the kind of treatment he was doing. Also, but I think this is even more meaningful, this was the time when was the time of kind of the cult rage for altered states of consciousness and amateur popular efforts at biofeedback and unverified claims of people with no real credentials. These people were out there and it just completely discredited Barry Sterman's work because people associated neurofeedback with that. And he just couldn't get a grant. I mean, no more. There was no more. And so the field, what has happened is it's almost entirely what we call anecdotal evidence, people mm-hmm. trying this and that here, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and people make all kind of claims for it, and sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes it seems to, and sometimes it's a placebo, so, you know, we don't really know. There's never been the grants that would be necessary to have systematic studies on what what uses this can be put to, how effective it is, and what's actually going on in the brain, a real physiological analysis of what's going on in the brain when this occurs. That has moved forward to a certain extent. But on the whole, it was just a whole very promising area of medicine which just was stalled and is pretty much lost. And he says now that if someone asks him to recommend some well-qualified people who can do this, doctors or practitioners, that there would be only one or two in most states in the United States. So it's been pretty much lost.
Wow.
And so it sounds like it's not that we know that this would be a marvelous cure for all. You know, it's claimed that it's good for epilepsy, attention deficit disorder, and brain injury. We don't really know, but I tell you, after having read about it, I think if I had someone that I loved who was suffering from any of those things, or if I were, I wouldn't ignore it. I would look into it. And so that's kind of where I am on that. It's just sad that we don't know more about it. So it is lost.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, the book is mm-hmm. Lost Science, Astonishing Tales of Forgotten Genius. Our guest is Kitty Ferguson. And what a great book you've put together. Really interesting. And thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Mm-hmm. Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Cool Science Radio. These are really interesting stories, and they are very, very accessible, which is sort of what she's made a whole career of doing, as we talked about.
What she said in her introduction was that her publicist came to her and said that this book, Hidden Figures, that we reviewed, and we had the author on our program, that this was a story that had never been told before. What other science stories are out there that haven't been told?
No kidding.
And so she took that as her assignment, and she found these fascinating stories.
Yeah. I mean, when we read and then saw the movie Hidden Figures, I could not believe that this story had not been told before. And Margot Lee Shetterly, who wrote the book, was the same way. But she said, okay, this is a story that hasn't been told. I've got to tell it.
And what a great story.
Absolutely. Well, stay with us. We'll be back to talk about, Some more lost science, shall we say, how politicians mistake, misrepresent, and utterly mangle science with Dave Levitin. When we return, stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. There are a bunch of ways our guest Dan Levitin says that enemies of science distort the facts. You know, science. A politician will begin by saying, well, I'm not a scientist, and then goes on to butcher scientific knowledge in whatever way suits his or her purposes. How about stating a scientific claim but switching up the facts, making the facts foggy? Often a politician presumes to represent the scientific community, but only cites maverick or disreputable sources. Dan Levitin is a journalist whose work appears in Scientific American, Slate, and many others. He brings us a clever, compelling, and enjoyable book called Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. This is on the eve, of course, of many marches for science taking place this Saturday, Earth Day, around the country, and actually right here in Park City on Main Street. Dan Levitin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. Your book was fun, but it was sad in a way because it really speaks directly to the current state of affairs in our country, which is nobody seems to tell the truth anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Although I guess I would say that it's not nobody. That if we want to look on the bright side, there are still some who are willing to tell the truth or at least try and address it as well as they can. But I agree, it does feel like something of a sort of depressing state of affairs at the moment in that regard.
Yeah. And so your book is a fun read. It's a quick read, and you have a number of gimmicks, tools that politicians will use: the oversimplification, the cherry pick, the butter up and undercut, the demonizer. Let's talk about a couple of these. How about the oversimplifications?
Sure. So that's probably sort of the most basic of the errors or tricks that I talk about. It's pretty much what it sounds like. A lot of times politicians will take what is, you know, can be a very complicated topic and boil it down to basically a soundbite, some pithy little quote that just kind of ignores all the subtlety and nuance that goes into all sorts of scientific issues. Of course, it can be useful to boil down complicated topics to help people understand them. But if you do that and just sort of abandon any semblance of you know, validity or support for the way you're doing it, you're really doing everybody a disservice. So people do this on all sorts of things. Things like saying marijuana is a gateway drug. Well, that's a complicated topic. There's a lot of research into that. And just saying it without actually going into those details, you're really just kind of confusing people rather than helping people understand it.
So, Dave, in the beginning of your book, you start off by talking about President Ronald Reagan back in the 80s and talking about sulfur dioxide and Mount St. Helens. Tell us that story. And is this, you know, according to what you're talking about here, is that's when it started, this I'm not a scientist, but...
Yeah, that was the first example I could find. I should say, I can't promise that no one's used it before that, but that was certainly the first one that I found. It was actually still during the presidential campaign in 1980. Ronald Reagan was asked about sulfur dioxide emissions, which is the primary component of acid rain. And he talked about how he thought that Mount St. Helens, which had erupted recently, how it had contributed far more sulfur dioxide to the atmosphere than humans did. And he prefaced it by saying, I'm not a scientist, but I think that Mount St. Helens is worse at this than we are. And it turns out he was completely wrong about that. There were not St. Helens did release sulfur dioxide, but in fact humans, mostly through burning of fossil fuels and at factories and industrial sites, we released far more than a single volcano did. So he was pretty far off on that, but he did sort of, I guess, give birth to this talking point that then has persisted through the decade.
I believe you came up with the data point, which is Mount St. Helens gave off about 2,000 tons of sulfur dioxide daily, whereas humans in this country with all their cars give up about 81,000 tons of sulfur dioxide daily.
Yeah, that's right. And when you start to look at, sources around the world, it gets even more sort of skewed in favor of humans. We managed to dominate natural sources in a lot of ways like that. And in fact, there was an era that was very similar, I discussed later in the book. Decades later, Mike Huckabee talked about volcanoes again, and he still got it very wrong, although this time he was talking about carbon dioxide rather than sulfur dioxide. But he was wrong by even more, many, many orders of magnitude wrong. Humans are by far the dominant source of carbon dioxide.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Dave Levitin. He's written Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. Dave, in the early 90s, in the late 80s, I was running a federal division, and actually I was running a whole country, but I had the federal group under my responsibility. And calling on NASA, they had this big change where they said, we're doing all this exploring outside of our Earth, but we're going to now focus, we think we should focus on our own planet and trying to understand it. And they put a number of satellites up, and they created a tremendous amount of data, and they would analyze it on weather patterns, on all sorts of different things. And so what really caught my attention in your book was the butter up and undercut when Ted Cruz praises NASA and then slams them on the budget side. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that technique, basically, as you said, it involves praising a certain topic, usually a topic that has a lot of public support. So people like NASA. NASA is very popular. Or other things like, cancer research, things that are very hard to criticize because the public generally agrees with them. However, you praise them, and at the same time, you sort of subtly try and cut their legs off, cut funding for a certain part, or just generally try and undermine the support for that thing. So in the case of Ted Cruz and NASA, he sort of went out of his way to praise NASA, to praise astronauts and all the scientists doing all this great work when it comes to exploring the solar system or the sun and all these sort of outside of Earth kinds of projects. But at the same time, he said we needed to start focusing outward rather than inward. And he would use phrases about how NASA has lost its core mission because they're focusing too much on Earth science. Now, that was sort of ridiculous in a lot of ways, but his point was basically to try and defund climate change research because NASA is one of the primary sources of climate data and research that we have through a lot of those satellites and everything that you mentioned. But he really sort of misrepresented the science there because NASA has been doing that sort of thing for, as you said, decades. And in fact, you can go all the way back to the founding documents of NASA that in 1958 Again and again in the years since then, you can find documents that talk about studying our own atmosphere. That has been a core mission of NASA from the very beginning. So his claim that, NASA is great because we go explore Pluto, but not because we explore Earth, is really kind of a bit of misdirection. And it really serves to sort of undermine the support for that institution.
And that core mission in the late 80s and the early 90s was actually signed off by Congress and supported by Congress. So I don't understand how he can come in and think that he can completely manipulate and change the mission just because he doesn't want to talk about climate change. But a lot of that goes on today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's relatively easy for a politician to get away with, in a sense, because, I mean, if you ask, a person who might not know the history of it, what does NASA do? They might say, well, we go to the moon or, we study Jupiter. I mean, these are sort of very commonly understood things. And of course, NASA does do those things. But it's a little bit easier to say if you're someone who's trying to cut climate change funding, to try and pretend that we haven't been looking at our own atmosphere and you know, related issues, studying ice in the Arctic and everything. These things are things NASA has been doing for so long, but it's sort of easy to jump in there, you know, and sort of change the path a little bit.
Dave, we spoke last month or so with a writer for Wired magazine, who had gone to Macedonia on and done an expose on fake news and talked about, you know, who believes fake news most readily and who doesn't buy it at all, presumably for their smarts and their ability to decipher, shall we call it BS, when they hear it. And I suppose that you've written this book, Not a Scientist, for some of the same reasons, to give us a little training on how to not be so darn gullible when it comes to what our politicians say. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess that's the hope. I mean, obviously, when it comes to science in particular, these can be very complicated topics. I mean, we can't possibly expect all of us to, you know, have training in all the things that government deals with in terms of science. There's just too much, and it can be very complicated. So my hope was just to give a few tools to sort of, you know, see through some of the ways that this gets misused by politicians. So there are some sort of tips in there that maybe can help, I don't know, maybe gain a little bit of skepticism when we're listening to politicians talk about science. So, you know, that could be... Sorry, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering what it is neurolinguistically that makes us believe that we're about to hear some well-founded science when someone says, I'm not a scientist, but, I mean, why do we then expect science?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I guess I might say that I'm not so sure we all do. There was, okay. As I mentioned in the introduction of the book, there was even a Republican sort of strategist and consultant who called that line, the I'm not a scientist line, he called it the dumbest talking point of all time. So even people who sort of use it maybe have come around to the idea that it doesn't really help anybody. So, but I agree that, you know, it sort of sets us up in a way to maybe take what we're about to hear with a grain of salt. It almost makes it so that we don't expect that much of what's coming, if that makes sense. And then maybe some of these errors or you know, sort of tricks and devices can slip past us a little easier.
Yeah. I just want to say this morning I was driving to work thinking about when I say things like that, I'm not a scientist, but granted, I'm not a politician trying to sell my point one way or another. But I do often say, now don't quote me on this, but, you know, I read this article, and this is, you know, it's my way of wanting to share something without possibly having all the hard, you know, facts. Is human nature, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, I've certainly done the same thing. I will, you know, tell people I'm not entirely sure about this, or this could have been, you know, I'm not sure if this was double-checked by someone. I don't think that instinct that you have, or that probably a lot of us have, is necessarily... a bad thing, or is necessarily quite the same as the way politicians are using it. I think they're using it more sort of as a smokescreen, in a way, as a way to give themselves cover when they do go out and actually, you know, develop policy based on what can be some pretty unsound science. When you do it, I think you're just trying to help people understand that there might be some that you might be wrong, that it might be something that you're not entirely sure about. So I'm not sure it's quite the same, and I think that it's admirable to want to tell people that there is uncertainty in what you're going to tell them about.
I think that people wouldn't dodge or fabricate or falsify the truth or you know, play on emotions unless they could get away with it. And if they're speaking to their base of supporters, I mean, we have a divided country. If they're speaking to their base wants to hear this because it complements and supports their belief system. And, you know, the thing I was thinking about as I read your book was that, you know, when we fell out of the tree and started walking upright many, many years ago, since that time, there have been snake oil salesmen and people that would sell you swampland in Florida or the Brooklyn Bridge. But it just seems to me that although this fabrication has been going on forever, that there's a change that's taken place in just the last 40 years or so, and for lack of better better word, that lying is more commonplace, almost accepted. And I don't know what it's all about, but it just seems, you know, I mean, people don't wake up, or they're not born as liars. They first tell a little white lie, then this happens, that happens, and it happens gradually. Maybe a society progresses the same way. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I don't have a, you know, a sort of clear answer to that either. It does feel, as you say, like there seems to be more tendency to lie about things these days. There is a chance, though, that's more sort of like perception bias in a way, that because we are able to look things up a little more quickly, that we are able to find an answer a lot easier than when Ronald Reagan said, "I'm not a scientist," in 1980, that it might just feel like it's happening more. But in fact, it maybe didn't, and it's just that we are able to find them quicker. I mean, in a way, that's sort of an optimistic answer, because it means that we're doing a better job, you know, kind of cutting through some of those. I'm not entirely sure that's true, but it does feel like maybe there's a little bit of just sort of a change in the way we process information, and that is making it seem like it's happening more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and to that point, and I think it's a good one, you can get data to support any viewpoint. So if, you know, if some people believe that 99.9% of scientists believe that man is contributing to climate change, you can go out there and you can find someone that says that that's not true. You know, it's only 50% of the scientists, or 55%. And people will take those data points, knowing that they're false, and they'll just restate them or repackage them. So there's, you know, the internet is an opportunity to support your lies and to, you know, sort of hoodwink the public.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I have a chapter in there called "The Blame the Blogger," which is exactly as you say. There's for every good information out there, there's some source of bad information too. And oftentimes, if there is something online that supports a particular politician's position or ideology, they'll use it just knowing that, like, they can blame that source rather than taking the blame themselves, even if the source is not remotely reputable. So as you said, one of the examples was about the consensus surrounding climate change, where some people on a blog basically wrote a post saying that 97% was actually closer to 43%. I forget the exact number, but they took, you know, just remarkable liberties with some math in a survey. I mean, it didn't really make a ton of sense, but it could be hard to understand that if you don't have time to go look up every survey that's ever been done on this. When a politician says that in a speech or on television, that one was actually on Bill Maher's show, you know, it can be hard to see through.
It's really disheartening to me that there is even a conversation that is partisan surrounding science, but it's very real and very current. And as we mentioned in our introduction, the March for Science going on in various towns around the country this Saturday. One's taking place on Main Street right here in Park City, where various scientists will be speaking. You know, you implicate, John Boehner, Rick Perry, Marco Rubio, even Trump to some degree, although you say in your prologue that your book was mostly written by the time he was elected. So maybe there's a whole other book, as you say, that could be written about that. But do liberals are they implicated in some way? Where's the guilt there?
Yes, absolutely. I did not intend the book to be sort of a partisan statement. I readily acknowledge that most of the examples in there are from one side of the aisle. I think that that's really just a reflection of reality. I don't think it's a particularly partisan statement to say that the Republican Party has definitely been on the wrong side of scientific issues for quite some time now, just from a scientific perspective. But that's not to say that it's only Republicans. There are Democrats that do appear in the book. President Obama is in there a couple times with some admittedly sort of minor errors that he has made on science. And there are some issues that tend to cross party lines a little bit differently. Genetically modified organisms are actually sort of the main one I can think of on that, where there doesn't seem to be as strict a partisan divide on who is misunderstanding or misinterpreting the available scientific knowledge. So while, yes, it is certainly mostly one party these days, it's not all that party, and I certainly don't think that, you know, one side of the aisle will have a monopoly on scientific expertise forever. There's no reason it couldn't flip at some point.
And I just say that really so that if we have some partisan folk out there, some conservatives that are listening and maybe turned off by this book, it's a really great, I think that's why I said it. Don't be turned off. Let's go into it. Let's gather the facts and let's learn, all of us, what to watch out for and those little trigger statements that, you know, after which we ought to, you know, our shackles ought to be up a bit.
Yeah, I hope that's the result. I hope that people can go into it sort of understanding that I'm really trying to help, you know, gain an appreciation for evidence, that no matter what politician is talking about science, that they need to be able to support a claim, and they need to be able to provide evidence no matter what.
Dave, I have to ask you about your dedication. To my wife, Jamie, and to Schrodinger's cat, the cat will know why, but only if you ask it. You got to talk about that.
Well, that's a good question. Basically, I mean, I don't know how much everybody knows about Schrodinger's cat, but the idea was this was a thought experiment where a cat is in a box, and if you leave the box closed, there is a chance every second that the cat will be either alive or dead.
Right.
So, and until you open the box and observe it, technically, according to quantum mechanics, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time.
Exactly.
So that concept sort of came up on my very first date with my wife. and my point about you have to ask it is that issue of observation, right? The cat does not have to decide if it's alive or dead until you open it and look at it.
Right.
So the cat knows the answer to this, but it won't know until you actually ask it. That was my point there.
And I always thought that it was just a bizarre thought experiment, when in fact Schrodinger and Einstein, who used to hang out and talk about these sorts of things, they, or Schrodinger presented it, and Einstein agreed to discuss the absurdness of quantum mechanics, quantum theory. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. That thought experiment was designed to sort of make people think this whole thing was ridiculous, but it turns out, I mean, it doesn't work for a cat, but it does work for fundamental particles. That idea of, superposition of states and observation being required before they decide on which state they're in, it's all actually bizarrely true.
Right. Well, Dave Levitin has written Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. It's a fun read again. We want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. That was fun.
Okay, it's fun for us too. Thank you. We are going to take a short break. We will return right after these messages. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
We want to thank our underwriters, Picart & Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. Lynn and I and a bunch of other people will be out on Main Street Saturday morning, 8 o'clock at the top of Main Street by the Brew Pub for the Science Walk. Join us. We're going to have some fun, and we're going to listen to some interesting talks as well. Everybody get outside and have some fun.